Everyone, thanks for coming late in the day. So we have a packed session, so we'll get started quickly. So let's first, because there's a whole bunch of us that did work on this one. So let's have a quick intro from the core members of the team. So you guys want to start?
Marley Wright, Microsoft.
Andreas Freund, Consensus.
Jim Nang, Kaleido.
Engineer Machine.
Yuan Neat, Chenning.
Laser Adit.
Michael Anzo, Consensus.
Joshan Kevigan, Isaac.
Sanjay from Intel. So, as you can see, it's quite a cross company effort. So today, you know, we're going to talk about this off-chain trusted compute. This work started off almost 2 years ago, and within the context of enterprise Ethereum as an option to address scalability and privacy. So what I will do quickly is, like, you know, give you some little bit of a history, and then drop into, you know, the meaty details of it. So we were. We were going to show, actually walk you through some hands-on demonstrations, but the internet access here is very interesting. So we're going to just walk you through and give you enough pointers on GitHub where you guys can go and you know, try it out at your own convenience. So there are going to be two of these walkthroughs that the team will introduce, and then hopefully we will have enough time to have some case studies that three case studies that people have put together around how they are using trusted compute. So quick on enterprise Ethereum, the focus is how to apply Ethereum in the enterprise world, and the main challenges when it comes to enterprise, we call them 3 P's, permissioning, privacy, and performance. We looked at, performance and privacy are two of the more important ones, and we looked at, like, your trusted compute as an option for solving those kinds of things. So we have made a lot of progress on that one. We introduced it last year, 0.5 spec at DevCon 4, and now we have a 1.0 spec out there, and reference implementations also are available for people to play with, and we'll walk you through some of that in the session. And as I said, is like, you know, some of the key salient features of this spec are privacy, confidentiality of the data as required for the enterprises, addressed oracles, and also support for things like decentralized identities in it. So it's a pretty rich spec. It has gone through a lot of work, and more than welcome to take a look at it and see how it fits into your businesses. The thing is, like, right now the spec has, when we talk about trusted compute, there's a lot of the PE in it, but what we have in there is supporting of other forms of trusted computation, like ZK proofs, multi-party computation, and things like that. A lot of that is in there, so but a lot more work needs to be done. With that, I will hand off to Andreas for, yeah.
Hello, everyone. I would like to say first a thank you to all the collaborators. It was truly an amazing journey. It is the first time that the EEA has produced shippable code, and it is the largest enterprise collaboration in the blockchain space, period. Right? There are 5 companies that have worked together to produce this EEA Trust Reward Token. This is the goal of this token model is to incentivize participation of EEA member organizations and their employees. Why is that important? Because it is very hard to get people to contribute. It's always the same usual suspects. The goal is to apply some of the learnings from the open ecosystem space around incentive models to see whether it can be leveraged in the enterprise. So there is experimentation with different token principles and design templates. We're eating our own dog food here. We want to create synergies with other EA groups, so the testnet group, the token taxonomy initiative that Marley's heading, and the new technical token working group, as well as open Ethereum specs, so the ERCs, Mike will talk about that, and then web standards, W3C. We're actually using the W3C standards for DIDs and verifiable credentials. Mike will also talk about that. And this is really the use case for the Trusted Compute Framework spec and the EA Trusted Compute Testnet. So that's really, really important, and we are creating a first simple use case that is actually usable, and that is also a first. So enterprises can actually start using tokens in their day-to-day operations, because this model is easily transferable into one enterprise or between multiple enterprises and other consortia. And with that, I want to hand it over to Marley to talk a little bit more about the details of the token model.
Thank you. All right, so what we wanted to do was to figure out the business process of solving the difficult problem. How do you get consortiums comprised of multiple corporations, some of which might compete with each other, to actually lean in and do the work to contribute to the benefit of all, which is pretty difficult to actually pull off. So we wanted to create an incentive, I like to call them behavioral modification protocols, to incent good behavior and punish bad behavior. But you also have to, because we're trying to scope out work that needs to occur, you need to do this in a way that you say it's the potential to earn these rewards. So we'll talk about the tokens, and then we'll talk about how we actually grant them really quickly. First off, we do these, we essentially create a grant, and it's the potential for an organization that's given to the organization to receive X number of reward tokens if they achieve the goal laid out in the grant. And that's the potential, and they can have individual contributors. So the actual people that are doing the work, we want to actually get the credit for doing that work, be able to use it, so we can list who those people are, and they can get a percentage of that total reward if it's achieved. There's also a punishment. Well, the punishment may equal the sum or negative value of the total reward, and you can set that in the grant as well. And then there's also something we call a reputation token, so we'll talk about that as well. Those are granted. Those are one for one with the reward token. But essentially what the reward token does is it's a token that that organizations can, when you are granted them, let's say the reward grant vests and you're rewarded, the organization is rewarded those tokens, they can take those tokens and redeem them for value of some sort. We'll talk about what we're actually providing here in a minute. You go to the next slide, it's fine. So you can go out and shop at the EEA swag store and get some really interesting materials, some t-shirts, dinner with Ron. That doesn't mean Ron's going to pay the dinner. You just get to have Ron come with you.
No, the EEA pays the dinner.
And then, and sunglasses. But this was more for just to show what you could do. Really, one of the things we wanted to put in the grant as well is to have, because it's consortiums, we made up organizations, we might have participants like Microsoft contribute to have a bounty in there and say, hey, we're going to put up some offices or some Xboxes so that the contributors actually meet the goal. They'll actually get something they want at the end of that goal. So really, we want to leave the model open to say that you can reward them. So interesting things about this is, if you get a reward token, the reputation flows to the individual, so the individuals will get a percentage. If there's 100 tokens and there are three or two participants, you can divide up those reputation points. So if it was equal effort by both participants, then they'll get 50 reputation points each. The cumulative will roll up to the individual. Penalty tokens, essentially, are negative value. They all have to be redeemed before you can redeem your reward tokens. So they'll decrease your overall balance for dictating whether or not you have to settle for the autographed sunglasses that I provide, or even slumming down with a t-shirt. So this is how these tokens will work and create this business model for doing that. So let's move on.
Yeah. So I think now what we'll get into is the real meat in terms of how this trusted token was implemented and why the trusted compute actually all fits in and everything else. So they want to bring us through that.
Good afternoon, everyone. So since early last year, so Isaac has been significantly working with Intel, Consensus, and the other EM members to work on the trust computing framework and move forward the related specifications and interesting use case, just like EEA token. So firstly, before talking about technical details, I would like to take 2 minutes to talk about a phenomenal question for me. Why we need actually offload the on-chain execution to the off-chain trust execution environment? So nowadays, there are a lot of on-chain applications that are smoothly running on on-chain network to support a great number of interesting use cases. But for some of these use cases, we are just starting realizing that there could kind of be limits. Take example, what about if the execution is becoming, needs to be upgraded frequently? So if everything's deployed on on-chain networks, it will be costly, right? And for some other use cases, some execution logic could be very, very complex and sophisticated. And it is costly. And if it's running on the Ethereum virtual machine, probably it's not so efficient if the application becomes so sophisticated, right? So we have an idea. Why don't we just migrate this execution from on-chain to the off-chain trusted execution environment? So if the application runs in the on-chain network, runs on the off-chain networks, so whenever you want to upgrade applications, it just represents nearly zero cost. And the off-chain execution can hold sophisticated applications with incremental efficiency. What's more, in the off-chain networks, all the execution logic can be coded in almost any of the mainstream languages like Java, Python, JavaScript, or Go, even C or C++, right? So, and what's more, the execution running in the off-chain networks, it offers better performance because just executed once based on the compiled code. It allows to very seamlessly talking with external data source based on the corresponding API calls. And one of the great features brought by the TEE is that it offers an end-to-end privacy preserving. Actually, all this data could be strictly encrypted. The decryption can only happen inside this TEE enclave. So the privacy is guaranteed by the hardware level security. So here's a diagram that you can see that originally we can deploy smart contract and trigger smart contract via the on-chain network based on a private key here, which is used to sign the blockchain transaction. And now we could migrate this smart contract execution logic to an off-chain trust execution environment enclave. And we only need to transfer this private key to this TEE enclave via a high secure channel. And after applying the execution logic, a blockchain transaction can be transferred directly from the TE enclave. In the name, so this blocking transaction is triggered in the name of the owner here, because only the private key is transferred to TE enclave, and no one else is able to inspect and tamper this private key. So in this way, we can offload the execution from on-chain to off-chain networks without sacrificing the user experience, without sacrificing the trustness and the security. So, as I just mentioned, that it's a great idea to migrate the execution from the on-chain to off-chain if, for example, if execution needs to be upgraded very frequently. So that is the case for TE token execution logic. So here is a diagram of the architecture diagram of the TE token, which is composed by four principal parts. So here are the UI parts, which allows a user to find the EA token request. And the EA token request could be then captured by the TE listener model. And the TE listener model could then trigger the TE SGX applications, so which represent TE EA token execution logic, runs inside the SGX TE enclave, so the SGX enclave, which is deployed in the Microsoft Azure SGX virtual machine. And after applying the execution logic, the blockchain transaction can be triggered from the TE enclave directly in the name of the TEA administrator. So this is, as Andreas mentioned, this is a great cooperation work from the different EA members. So the Avision blockchain takes charge of the implementation of the UI part, and Isaac takes charge of the implementation of the TEE listener, as well as the TEE SGX application implementation. And deploy the trust compute framework to the Microsoft Azure SGX virtual machine. Isaac also takes charge of the implementation of the TCF TEE contract. And ConsenSys takes charge of the implementation of the EEA trust token smart contracts. And Clido takes charge of the deploying the blockchain networks. Actually, the blockchain networks is based on Clido network, based on the Hyperledger dash, so previous name is Passion. So I leave Mike to talk about the smart contract implemented by the ConsenSys.
Thank you. So in the smart contract layer, we have three components: the one tokens, second are centralized identifiers or DIDs, and the third one is going to be verifiable claims. So how we make this ecosystem work is we deployed these three contracts as an operator contract on TOPS, managing the contract's admin functions such as burn, mint, transfer, etc. Right. So to be able to do that, we need to make sure that we have the participants that are receiving the tokens are one employees of an organization, and two, the organization is a member of the EEA. And that is where the ERC 780 and the 1056 come into play. The ERC 780 is a contract, it's a claims registry contract, originally developed by Uport, and we've adapted it for this use case, and essentially it's a contract where we allow the EEA admin to specify which organizations are members of the EEA. And then the second contract is going to be the Ethereum DIB registry, or the 1056. That's also a contract standard that was developed by Uport. And it's going to allow an organization to specify who is an employee of the organization. So this is not an EA admin function, because we don't want that function. We want the organization themselves to specify who's working on their behalf or their delegates. So the function we're actually really interested in is the set delegate function in 1056. So that in organizations can actually set the employees as delegates working on their behalf, so that when we mint tokens, the EA admin, when they select mint tokens, it's going to check, one, is the organization an EA member through the 780, and then two, it's going to check if the employee is the participant is an employee of the organization under the 1056. And then from there, we mint their tokens based on with the amount.
Okay, so this is gonna get increasingly more complex, so let's just bear with us. Before we step through this chart, let's use an example of why are we bothering doing all this stuff. That's the heart of the trusted compute. So who knows about ERC-20? Right? So we're talking about tokens, non-fungible tokens. So ERC-721? Okay, so fungible tokens and non-fungible tokens. I run those in the chain, everybody knows who they're going to, and I have issuer that has the secret key and sign them and push the request and you get the token. What's the problem? Why do we need all this in the middle? Let's use this example. Let's say Ron is the holder of the secret key that I can issue tokens. Mint the token to organization one, so they get some reputation tokens, right? And let's say Ron looks uncorruptible, so that's not going to work. Let's say Charles. Charles is the holder of the private keys. And I know Charles for a long time, so I know he loves exotic whiskey, right? So we're going to make a deal. Charles, for every token you issue to Kaleido, I'm going to give you a case of whiskeys. So what this means is, as long as I can corrupt the secret key holder, I can get all the tokens I want, right? And there's no safeguard to make sure that transaction is legit. You can only trust as much as you trust the person that holds the private key. So what we want is some sort of safeguard to make sure when the minting request is being issued, it's issued by meeting a bunch of criteria that's set in place. Okay, now you think about this. We need criteria. Why don't we just put them in the smart contract that stands in front of ERC-20 and does the validation and then calls ERC-20, right? That's easy to solve. It can be solved this way if all your checking can be done on the chain. If all the data is available on chain, you can do this very easily. There are a lot of situations where the checking needs to consult external databases, look at the logs, look at the meeting minutes from administrators, and do the validation from outside resources that's not reachable from smart contracts. And that's where this kind of solution makes it very handy. So let's step through this and see how this works in the cover. Right, so before this can flow end to end, we need to do two things. We need to make sure the secret keys are in place. So first of all, you have the front end, and you have the blockchain. And then somebody needs to hold the signing key that has the special power of minting tokens. So that's going to exist at this layer we call Trusted Compute Listener. This is basically an API service that makes the system work together with the front end. And then this is going to call some trusted system that you can say, when this system is executing some logic, I can be somehow guaranteed and convinced that it's running the right logic. And the magic is in the Intel guys technology called SGX, Safe Software Guard Extension. Thank you. So that you can be convinced that when it executes some logic, you know exactly what kind of logic was being executed in terms of getting a proof or attestation from a component. Because of that, we know that to mint the token, we have to have participation records, issuing, let's say, the organization participating GitHub commits that contributed to the publication of the next spec. That sort of thing can be checked here, and all the logic can run, and they can call any APIs they want, whether they are on-chain or off-chain, because this is just regular component that does compute. So that's the beauty of this solution. Once we've got the keys in the right place, the admin, Charles in this case, logs into the UI and then says, okay, Clido did some good work, let's give them some tokens. Send a request that's going to be accepted by the trusted listener. And the listener now needs to talk in secure mode so that this request going to the trusted compute component is going to be secured by public encryption. So only the component here can decrypt. So now the workflow goes to trusted compute. It's going to do the the logic and checking, and eventually once it passes the criteria, finally the token issuance request is made and tokens issued and everybody's happy. So that's the flow. This is only one pattern of what you can do with trusted compute. There's other like Oracle patterns where you can use it to get external data, and you can be assured that once it's grabbing data from external sources, they're not manipulating them, right? So there are very sensitive data in the world that can mean like millions and billions of dollars, even if you tweak it just a tiny bit. When you are getting that data from this kind of components, you know they're not manipulated. So, what we have done with the EA token project is, if you go to this link, you will see all the components that's involved to make this work. Mike already took you through the smart contracts. It took about 10 different smart contracts to work together. So take your time to understand what each of them do. And then the TE layer that iExec folks did has two components. One is that API layer that takes the request from the UI, and then that launches the worker node that actually does the processing through a secure channel. And finally, the Envision folks, Envision blockchain folks did the UI work to make it integrate into the EA member website. And finally, Marley and his team did the modeling to make sure the stuff that we do is compliant to the TTF spec. So you can check out the stuff from the repository, and if you have any questions, feel free to open the issue and we can engage. To help folks understand that this is real and this works, we did a live deployment that's running in Azure and Clido, so that all the components outside of the blockchain is deployed to Azure, including the SGX cluster, and then the blockchain itself is managed by Clido, which is also on Azure. And then if you want to try this yourself, right, how these different components work together under the cover, we also created a local environment that's based on Docker and Docker Compose. So just following the README, you can try this yourself and run everything end-to-end without relying on a cloud component. So that's what I'm trying to take you through in the next, hopefully 15 to 20 minutes of stepping through all the different components so you can see this thing running at the end. And let's get to that now. Any questions so far about any of this stuff?
Where's my whiskey?
There's one in the back.
Okay, yes.
Okay, this is an open source project. Why not just use Gitcoin?
Gitcoin?
Why not just use Gitcoin?
Oh yeah, if somebody, anybody is welcome to create a bounty project and see how people can improve on top of this, right? What we've done is one pattern. Again, this is just one pattern. You can do with TCF, and there's other patterns you can implement. That's a great idea. All right, so before I go to the code, this is sort of the the simplified version of the local environment compared to the real version that's deployed to the cloud. We have these components that I already talked to you about. So how the heart of the secure compute component is a secure channel between the component that's owned by EA admin, and at some point that needs to call a stateless worker node that's, you know, can serve anybody. So how does that communication happen securely is through a secure channel. If you want to know any details, ask these guys. We don't need that for a local environment. So what we do is using a shared file system, we have something generated by the T listener that's committed to a file system, and this file system is shared by the worker node. So that's how the secure provisioning is happening between the two. And then the blockchain itself is Hyperledger Vesu, running locally through Docker Compose.
Right. Let's
take a look. Feel free to stop me anytime if you see something that you'd like to understand more about.
Can you increase the size?
Increase the size of that.
Oh. Thank you.
More.
More, okay. Make this smaller.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Is that good enough for the folks on the Invec row? Ignore this. Is that good enough? What do you think?
You should tell us what it says.
Make it huge.
All right. Okay. Let's make it huge.
Be bold.
There we go. Bigger, bigger. Bigger. Okay. So let's do some cleanup first. All right. By the way, I mentioned the GitHub. So if you go to the GitHub at the link, switch to DevConf. Branch, and then you can see, of course. All right, never mind. We don't need that for the demo. Go to the DevConf branch, and then go to the local folder, and then there's a readme through all the steps you want. So if you want to try this at home, you can do that. All you need is Docker and Node.js. Okay, so what I've got is I've got three different Docker Compose that puts the system together. The first one is the deep backend, which is blockchain itself. It runs Hyperledger Vesu, the latest version, I think, which is 1.2.4. For every Vesu node, we need to run a companion component, which is essentially the wallet. Because we're lazy, we don't want to do external signing, so we just ask the node to do the signing for us. And this is giving the Vesu node a wallet. So that's what each signer does here. And then we have another Vesu node and another wallet that goes with it. So that's pretty simple. Let's fire this up. It's creating the two nodes and two wallets, right? So it's all working fine so far. And you can connect to them. Let's see if I have it. You can attach to that. See that it's running for real. OK.
right? So there you have it. We were in the console. We can see that it's already at block 14,000 something. Because I've been running this environment for a while. That's why it's got a bunch of blocks already. So now we have the backend. Let's fire up the contract. So I've already deployed the contract, so I'm not going to deploy it again. But what it does is, yeah.
It's unreadable. And it won't get readable.
We believe you. So there are these 10 different smart contracts that gives you a registry. It gives you a registry of the orgs. So when a request goes to the smart contracts to issue a token to the org, it's using the registry to verify that this org has been registered. And then when you want to issue to an employee, then the claims registry is used to verify that there's a claim about the associations of this employee to that organization. So that's how these things work. And then the main logic of processing the issue, the burn of the tokens is operator. So that's the main thing where the logics exist. And you have the different token contracts. Under the cover, they're all based on ERC-777 instead of ERC-20. It's an improved version of ERC-20 for non-fungible tokens, for fungible tokens. So that's been deployed. Let's start the middle tier, which is the TE stuff. So we have another doctor here. So what this does is it gives the APIs for the UI to call and then process requests. So this only needs one component, one Docker instance, because the actual worker nodes are spun up by this on demand. When there's a work request, it spins up a new instance of the worker node and then have it process it and then clean it up afterwards. Got that. Finally, let's put the UI. Okay. The UI has four different components. It's got the HTML layer, the backend layer in Node.js, and then a Nginx for load balancing and a database to save local information. So we've got everything running now. Let's look at the UI. Okay, so you need to do a login. So that's the default is admin pwd. So that's the when you try this yourself, admin pwd with the capitalized P is the password. Very secure for sure.
For the E.
Yes.
Or you have to ask Charles.
For a bottle of whiskey. Whiskey.
You
want
to ask.
So the first thing you do as a EA admin is to register some members, right? So let's register as a organization. So email .com. Great. All right, give us a password. So this is going to call the DID registry to register this new member within the organization. And it's stuck somehow. Let's take a look. saved user. Right? So it's supposed to call, oh, I know what's going on. I'm using the wrong branch. Yeah, I need to switch to DEFCON. Remember to use DEFCON branch when you work with this. Okay, I'll stash it away. So we need to rebuild the middle tier and UI tier. Bear with me for a second. All right, so that's rebuilt. Can you restart the UI as well? I needed to do this because earlier I was trying to connect the system to the cloud deployment. That's obviously not the right configuration. Right. Try this again. Register. DEFCON 5. Okay. Looks better. So now we've got a member as that's part of this consortium. Let's say EEA itself is a consortium. We just added DEFCON 5 as a brand new member. So now we're going to ask the admin of DEFCON 5 to add some employees. So I'm going to log in as DEFCON 5 admin. And as of now, I have 0 tokens. So I need to register some employees that's going to be assigned to work with EEA on great stuff, right? So employee 1, it's going to be part of DEFCON 5. As you can see, the email, we don't really use it to verify identities. It's just, you can give any email address if you want. All right, so now we have an employee that's part of DEFCON 5. Let's go back and say, you know, in half a year, DEFCON 5 employee 1 has been participating in all calls, and even chaired some calls, and even contributed to the next version of the spec, right? So it's time to give them some tokens. So they can have their dinner they've been waiting for with Ron. Okay, so it's going to be for DEFCON 5, employee 1, because they've written contributions. So what's happening on the cover is what is it called? TU listener 1. So this is all new. TE Listener 1, which is the API server, just saw that request from the UI, and then it understands that this is a request to issue some tokens. So it generated some command, and then asked the worker node to process this command. So the processing of the command is done in the trusted mode, right, by the trusted component. And as a result, some reward tokens were minted. So let's see if DEFCON 5 actually got that. I think it's Gmail. Did I use Gmail?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. You got 100 tokens because you did that. So If you didn't know what's happening under the cover, this may be underwhelming. But if you actually know that in this system, there's no way anybody can bribe Charles to get free tokens, then that's a really good thing. So thank you.
I'm not sorry for it.
Because you're not getting your whiskey?
Yeah.
So that was all of this is actually really.
Yes. So thanks, Jim, for the demo. So that demo is in runs in the simulation mode, which runs every component runs on the same local machine, right? So here actually is something running in the hardware mode, which is for the real use case. So basically, the TE, the components, and deployed on Microsoft Azure SGX virtual machine, and the blockchain based on the Clido networks. So the hardware mode, here the architecture of the, for the EA token hardware mode, it's kind of more complicated. The principal difference compared to the simulation mode is focus on the security enhancements. So basically for the UI part, it's the same. So UI can, the users can file EA token request, and the EA token request could be captured by the TE listener via a GWT security channel. And the TE listener is in the scope of the EA administrator. So the EA administrator can just inject signing key, the private key, to the TE listener, and TE listener will transfer this key to a secret management service, which is also running inside the Intel SGX enclave. And meanwhile, the TE listener will also encrypt the token request and push the encrypted token request to a data storage server. So all these components stays in the EEA administrator components, not yet go out of that scope. So the next step is that TEE will trigger the off-chain trusted execution. So there are two ways of triggering the TEE applications, the direct model and the proxy model. So for the direct model, actually TEE will query the blockchain and saying, hey, I want to trigger, for example, register warp one, what is his IP address and his configuration information. Then he could dialogue with this information retrieved from the blockchain. He can then dialogue with the register worker and trigger off-chain trusted computing. So this is direct model, it's more simple. And for the proxy model, actually TE listener will also find a new blockchain transaction, say that I will run this execution logic for the register worker A, and the register worker A will be always listening to the blockchain events, and as soon as he captured his blockchain events, he will trigger the TE applications. So as soon as the TE applications is triggered, SKU channel is established between the security management service and the remote TE enclave. So this remote SKU channel is also called SGX secret provision channel. So the signing key, the private key used to sign the blockchain transaction by the EE administrator, it can be transferred to the TEE enclave. So I would like to underline once again that the key running inside the enclave is guaranteed by the hardware, Intel SGX hardware level security. So even the owner of the TEE, the machine, is not able to penetrate this enclave and steal or tamper this private key. So the encrypted data also pulled to the TE applications. So TE applications is able to decrypt the data and apply the execution logic, and finally can provide a blockchain transaction directly to the blockchain networks based on the...
There's a question.
Okay.
The question is that in this Intel trusted environment, right, the key to the secret enclave does that the administrator will have the access.
For this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually this one, as since he also has running inside Intel SGX enclave, so even you don't trust this machine, because all the keys are running inside the enclave. So actually, when this machine runs, when this enclave starts running, it will also do the remote attestation.
So I mean, essentially, you have an admin cluster which will own this secret enclave.
Yeah, but
so
but this one is also in the admin scope actually.
I know, so, but essentially, you have to inherit trust the admin. So is there a case that with a consortium that each member can?
Yeah, good question. Actually, for the token issuance, for the all the token issuance request, it's unified by the administrator. Actually, but this for a different use case. For example, if a organization he want to maintain the reputation token for different employees, so this could be in the organization scope. So that is for a different use case. So for this token insurance, it's only for the EA administrator scope. So the transaction blockchain transaction can be triggered to the blockchain directly based on the signing, based on this signing key. So in the name of the EEA administrator, right? So in this way that we can see that we can off-chain all the execution from on-chain to off-chain without compromising the security and trustworthiness and the user experience.
So like this is like a real world application that we have, deployed as part of it's in a EEA spec compliant implementation, first of its kind, and hopefully we'll use it within EEA in the real way. And now the other part is like so we talked about this application. The second part is like Eugene will walk us through some of the. What does it take to write, we talked about, you can implement this thing in SGXT. So how hard or how easy is it? So he's going to walk through this framework that we have put together, and that will be open source, to walk you through, how we're making it easy to write a Hello World kind of an example.
Can you hear me without mic?
No.
Yes.
Yeah, just a question. I get this when there's like a single governor. How would this model work if you had to share the trusted logic to ensure that multiple parties are running the same exact trusted logic and agreeing on this is for you that information? And if that is possible, then how would you distribute that trusted logic in a way?
So, can you repeat this question?
Well, it seems like this model works if you have a single admin of the system and you have trusted logic that's put. But I'm curious when you have multiple parties that have to run the same exact trusted logic, how do you guarantee distribution?
These guys may have more specific answer. My view is the point that you're using this centralized component there is that you can trust it. Typically, you don't trust a centralized component because there's operator, there's some code that you don't know hidden away in some machines. You can't trust a centralized component, right? But this is a special kind of central component that you can trust because you can ask Intel to give you an attestation that's signed by Intel. If you found it wrong, you can sue Intel, and that's a pretty good thing to do, right? Which means you can trust this, and there's no reason that you have to run a decentralized system.
So you wouldn't use this for a model if you had like calculations that you wanted multiple parties to run.
So maybe we'll have an opportunity to present our use case. But basically, it's a very good question. But SGX allows you to attest the code that runs inside the enclave. So you publish it, and every participant can verify that what runs inside the enclave is what has been agreed upon.
Okay.
Can I answer that question?
Sure. See, this is why we have all these people.
So I'm with Enigma. We built this TCF implementation as a blockchain. So we can have multiple nodes run the SGX instance. We have a smart contract language that compiles into these nodes, and they can form consensus. So you can actually build a blockchain kind of consensus out of this.
And through that, you get the version
that. Sorry, can you repeat the answer?
I think in the interest of time, I think we'll get going, like, because he answered him about the attestation and things like that. So.
Yeah, my question was, goes all along the same line, curious everybody, is that single person of control, could it be replaced by some sort of a smart contract that actually feeds Oracle to the events that would kick a token issuance, if that is possible, which feels like it is? In which side does that smart contract go? And I mean, on the sense of, you know, would it be on the on-chain or be on the off-chain kind of side?
It would be a combination. You would have them kind of like executed on both sides, and you would execute the part of the code in the enclave, for example. So you will keep information that's known only to enclave or to group on the enclaves, but at the same time, you're going to have on-chain information that will maintain cryptographic proof of the execution without actual data. That is a typical the pattern that we're going to use in the Hyperledger Avalon. So we heard about the EA exciting use case. We're going to hear about a couple more exciting use cases. But now I have a privilege to talk about the most infamous and the most boring use case, Hello World. So without that, though, we cannot move forward. So what actually brings together the all use cases you're going to hear today about is actually that underneath we have the Hyperledger Avalon reference implementation of the trusted compute specification. So that is how Hyperledger and how the EA work together. So before we go into the, and initially it was intended as a tutorial, so we don't have really ability to go with, to do this hands-on. So that is why I'm going to kind of like go through the steps, what it takes to go through the, to build Hello World application. But then first we need to start with a little bit the background. And the architectural background, the very little, just to understand what is needed absolutely to build a Hello World application. So architecturally, Hyperledger Avalon includes three parts. It's a trusted compute service that runs the workloads and manages them. There are smart contracts that run in Ethereum that allows you to invoke these workloads in the trusted compute service. And there are always the requesters who wants to make this execution. And colors come very differently. So now a little bit about the colors. The dark blue in this case is actually that is the application code, and the everything else that is the code that is the implement in the common for the all applications. So the applications, in order to build application, you need to build three parts. The front UI, you need to build the smart contracts. You may use the smart contracts provided by the Hyperledger Avalon, or you may need to modify them and build your additional own smart contracts. But in reality, this part is actually well known how to build. But the workloads is actually very new. That is why we're going to focus today only on how to build these workloads. So we're going to pretty much build the Hello World application and learn how to build your own examples. So our Hello World application is going to be pretty simple. It's going to take as an input list of names and it's going to prepend the hello to each name and return this as a result. And we encourage the building the application in any workload in the two stages. First, get it plugged in into the framework and then actually to add your business logic. So, and we're going to follow the same pattern today. So there are a couple dependencies that we should be aware of. So the each workload has to inherit from the class process workload, and it has to implement one virtual function, and it needs to include a couple macros, and we'll talk about the details of that. There we provide a number of templates that actually make the, pretty much include the whole boilerplate code, so you don't really need to write it yourself. And finally, for this, in order to start your development, you don't need really to develop immediately your client. You can use a generic client provided with the framework to test your application. Next slide. So at the end, I'm going to distribute the USBs. As I said, that we plan to do this hands-on experience. So they include kind of like a cheating version. So it has the all components pre-installed, and it has the even the stage one pre-built. So it's, you can kind of like sample the Avalon without really going through the full installation and see how it works. That's right. So this is actually, let's start kind of from the end. Stage one, the what we're going to see if the we would have the stage one, what would be the result? So first of all, we would start the listener. This is the lower screen. And we would start the client application. In both cases, just when we're going to try, don't forget to source the Python virtual environment, otherwise nothing going to work. So when we're going to submit the command, the important parts, we submit the hello world, which is the ID of the workload that we built, and the raw data, Alice and Bob. So we're going to get result error under construction. And at the end of stage one, that is the expected output, because at this time, all we care, we want to make sure that hello world would cause the messages come to the our workload that we just integrated in the framework, but we don't really have our own business logic that yet. Next one. So what is actually it really takes to get to the stage one? First of all, we need to create a folder, like in any application, and that Hello World application name we have to keep because we will need to use this name a couple times more in the updates to the files. We will need to copy template files from the folder where we keep them, and we need to update a couple files in the among those templates and a couple more build files in the framework itself. So the first of all, there are three files that actually allows to build the Hello World workload. So first of them is actually one of the template files. That is the top one. It controls how to build a static library. The second one is actually the includes the building of this particular static library into the overall build process. And the third one is links that into overall set of workloads to be loaded in the enclave. So the highlighted items is actually what really has to be changed because everything else provided as templates. Next slide. Then we need to update at this stage one source file, a scatter file. So we have to make the three changes. So two of them, first and last, really the same. We just need to change the namespace because if we're going to use the same templates to for multiple workloads, they should not compete, and we should keep the compiler happy. And finally, we need to set the workload ID. And by the way, I made a mistake. It should be hello dash world, not the hello underscore world. Next slide. And the same slide. Next slide. Oops. Go back. Okay. So this is okay. So this is actually. So this slide is actually it just had initially the different color. So the what it actually shows here, not the changes, but the just elements that are important to understand why they're here. So we have to inherit from the workload processor class. We have to have this macro that actually allows us to clone the class for every execution we need. We need to implement this virtual function, and we're going to look at this implementation a little bit later. And finally, there is a helper function that just makes adding the output elements easier. Next slide. So now, if we were done with the stage one, so what would happen when we're going to be at the stage two? We're pretty much going to modify two more files, three more files. This is logic, that is where we're going to get the logic, the additional flag, file called plugin.cpp, that is actually the file that kind of links your logic with the framework, and we reveal this stuff, and when we run the same command, we're going to have the proper response, hello Alice and hello Bob. Next slide. So logic is actually where the developers will spend probably 99% of their time. And in our case, it's very primitive. It's just the function that takes the string, input string as a parameter, adds the hello, prepends it with hello, and returns the result. And the now, before we're going to look in what we actually have to change in the file that links the our business logic with the framework, we need to look in the previous implementation. This is a stubbed implementation in the template. So it has this macro register workload processor that just simply has to be present. There is the function process work order that has number of parameters that describe the workload submitted for execution. And the most important in work order data and out work data. And it has a hard-coded string error under construction that is converted in byte array and returned as a result. And as you can see, it completely ignores input. Next slide. And that is the function that we are going to implement in order to link the logic of the this hello world with the framework. So in this case, the for loop is actually allows you to enumerate through each input data. On the first iteration, it will have Alice. On the second, it will get Bob. Then what we're going to do, the data comes as a byte array, so they have to be converted to string and sent to the command process hello world. And once they process, the result comes as a string that again has to be converted to byte array and added to the work order result. And those two strings, the hello Alice and hello Bob, going to be returned to the output eventually. So the data in the process is going to do a lot of different processing. They're going to be encrypted, they're going to be signed, but all this is actually kind of transparent for the developer of the workload. As long as you provide this function that is going to be called, and you provide the workload ID, the framework will find your workload and will send the data to the workload for the execution. That's it.
So like, so those are like, you know, around plumbing and to start using spec compliant trusted computing implementation. So now, like, we have three case studies that three companies are building on top of this framework. The first one is from Santander, and Smuk will walk us through that.
How much time? 5 minutes?
I can take 10 minutes.
Okay.
Just take wait.
No, you. I'm Shamik Chimian. I'm from Banco Santander, and we are kind of a special car child of EA because we are not a software vendor, we are a bank. So we are not the smartest ones, but we are ones with interesting use cases. And we actually do have a lot of exciting use cases that we can't talk about, but there are maybe some that we can share. And SGX as a technology has been on our radar. We thought it could solve us some problems, but it's difficult. Now comes Avalon, comes SDK, so hopefully, you know, we are lazy and we are always looking how to piggyback on smart people's work. And let me walk you through the problem. It's, on one hand side, it's very boring because there is not much money involved. On the other hand side, it's interesting because it has many aspects that we want to cover and that are relevant in the exciting use cases. So we have three friends, Alice, Bob, and Eva. They are friends, but they're working for competing banks. And next slide, please. And each of them has a portfolio of VIP customers that he or she takes care.
And of course, it's like, you know, we are friends, but stealing a customer is a problematic thing. So next slide. With each customer set, there is customer data. Now, this customer data is precious. This customer data is something to be protected. This customer data is something we mustn't share. However, there are use cases, there are situations, there are regulatory requirements when we actually need to process consolidated data. So one very simple quasi-AML example is when we want to look for people sending money in a site. It's not true AML, but it's like, you know, you're making an impression of having money where you're not really. So this is the very simple logic that we use the templates provided by Sanji and Eugene, and we are contributing as an example to Avalon Hyperledger project, so that not only we have been able to do it, but well, the more so smart developers could be able to do it, should be able to do it. So this is a question of how to process consolidated data without disclosing it. Because we know we can have a gentleman's agreement, and we know that maybe it would work with Alice and Bob. But we all know something about Eva, right? So we mustn't trust Eva, but now comes the solution. And the solution is we do everything in a vault. We do everything in a special bunker. It's a software bunker. It's a bunker made of dreams of Sanji and Eugene and other people in Intel and other people from Avalon project. So we have this cryptographically secured enclave, and we seed it with a code that everybody has seen. And everybody, Alice, Bob, Eva, and whoever, I don't know why this is missing, but there are funny things happening as you move from Ubuntu to Mac to Windows. There should be this person. So there was this question about how to trust. Yeah? So thing is, if you seed the enclave with your code, you can verify that this is the code, provided that you trust Sanji. But this is a minor point compared, you know, we are a bank and people trust us with way more complex things and with way more rationality, less rationality behind it. So, agreed upon algorithm, enclave. Now, everybody takes an envelope from the vault, and everybody puts her data into the envelope, closes, seals, and puts it into the alembic, into the vault. Now, the algorithm kicks in. It's being processed. But nobody sees the assembled data, because assembled data is only consolidated in the protected memory. So out comes only the list of suspects. So we have solved our problem. And a little vocabulary here. So the bunker is the SGX enclave wrapped in the Avalon framework for our utility. The envelope is a public RSA key. So as we start the enclave, a key pair is generated, but only the public key is revealed. So everybody in the world can encrypt, but the stuff can only get decrypted inside the enclave. Or maybe by Sanji, I don't know. Now the seal, of course, we want commitment. We want people to certify that this is the data they want to commit. So there is an elliptic curve, Hibbs curve, actually signed signature on it. And now, a couple of questions here. So one was already asked, how can you be sure that there is no trapdoor, there is no any malicious code inside the enclave? So this we can do
by publishing the code and by publishing on-chain, and this is actually where blockchain comes in, because so far you could ask, okay, cool story, but why blockchain? What for? So one thing is, when I advertise my enclave to other banks, to other participants, I should offer a number of certificates to say, to guarantee that one thing is that the code there is actually this. And then if they use attestation service, if they have those cryptographic primitives, they can verify themselves that this is actually the code. There is no trapdoor, there is no funny thing. And the other question that you can ask is, how can we guarantee that people don't cheat by submitting false data? You know, if I'm Eva, Charles, if Charles is my customer, yeah, and I want to protect him from AML algorithms, I may be sending, you know, tampered data. But this actually is a moment when, again, blockchain comes handy, because I can gather commitments, I can gather essentially a hash of the submitted data. And then at any time in the future, an audit can come to this bank and say, okay, present the data and compare against the hash. So this is not perfect, but this is as good as can be, because if we protect the data, it's protected. So there is no verification of data quality, of data truthfulness. But what we can do is we can gather and memorize and store the commitment for future verification. So we've done this, and we are contributing this as a use case. And we've done this in a way that, like, we are properly paranoid about cryptography. So there are two components. One is the application, and we were ready to present, but, you know, time constraints, network networking. One component is the client that you talk to, the enclave, so that you discover the worker, that you get all the cryptographic primitives that you need, basically the keys and the addresses. And the other component is a standalone encryption application. So we say, okay, if you're really paranoid about your data, you don't want to encrypt in an app that is online connected to something. You just take the public key, you transfer it somehow, hopefully not on a Russian USB stick, to an air-gapped computer, you take it to the basement, there you do your encryption, there you build your JSON message, you bring it back to the application, you send it. And we stretch a little bit the framework, because you can recognize that the worker becomes stateful, because it waits for all the data states. But this is anyhow on the roadmap of the Avalon project. There is a couple of other tweaks that we needed to do, but, you know, we've managed to pull it off. So, thank you very much. It's, like, really exciting. These are screenshots, so, you know, you can connect. At the moment, there are some funny stories. Like, at the moment, the Avalon uses those pretty names to identify workers. Yeah. So normally, you go to blockchain, you would have a list of workers available. These are the names. Something to work upon. You press details and you get stuff that you actually need, like the encryption public key. So this is the stuff that you copy paste and you take to your basement computer. And yeah, and the other is a screenshot of the standalone encryption app. So first you need to define how many data stakes are there, then you need to submit your data as comma separated value files. In our, you will be able to work with this example, because we are committing this to do the Avalon project. It is already on the branch. Then you, of course, you create the JSON file. You may review the JSON file before it is encrypted. Then you encrypt the JSON file with the public key that you submit. So it's a very simple Python application, but it actually
guides you through all the steps that you need to create a ready, encrypted, signed, hashed message that the service would accept and process. And yes, amazing thing is it works. And I invite you to experiment like this. Thank you.
Thanks, Chama. The second use case we'll talk about is trusted oracles from Joanne from Chainlink.
All right. Hello, everyone. Thank you very much. So yeah, I'm Johan Eid. I'm from France, as you probably noticed from my accent. So today I would like to talk about how Chainlink can connect the TCF to real-world data. So when you started working on Chainlink, basically what you wanted to solve was how do we bridge public blockchains to real-world data? Because after all, a public blockchain without market data, insurance data, IoT data, doesn't have a lot of use cases, right? And we feel it's the same for the TCF. So the TCF provides a great framework to scale and to compute smart contracts in a private matter. However, how can we provide this Hyperledger Avalon with data, right? And how can we make sure that this data is as accurate and secure as possible? Because So currently the problem is the Hyperledger Avalon doesn't have access or safe access to data inputs. So we have this great framework which cannot access real-world data, right? And all of the great use cases require real-world data and events. So yeah, basically what you want to do is give access to the Hyperledger Avalon to payment methods such as PayPal, Swift, where basically, if you were to compute a smart contract in the TCF framework, you could trigger external actions, right? We also want to be able to allow My slides are a bit, basically, so we have multiple use cases. So we want to allow the TCF to get access to real-world data, so market data from Bloomberg, from Reuters. We also want to be able to trigger external payments with the TCF. And finally, the third use case is to basically allow the TCF to gain access to other blockchains. So basically, let's say you were to compute a smart contract inside the TCF, you could trigger a Bitcoin payment or an Ethereum transaction or even an Ethereum smart contract. So those are all great use cases that we've been working on implementing, basically. Yeah, next one. All right. So currently, we also want to guarantee end-to-end reliability. So the whole idea is that we use public blockchains in order to be tamper-proof, transparent, right? Use the TCF in order to scale and to guarantee privacy whenever we compute smart contracts. And we also want to make sure that the data that's being fed into the system is as secure as possible. After all, if we were to have a system which is processing real-world data inside an enclave, but you're not sure about this data, then you would run into a huge issue, right? Why do you have this super secure system which is being triggered by super insecure data? That's a problem, right? So what we've been working on at Chainlink is basically being able to have multiple sources which are fetching data from multiple data providers in order to make sure through redundancy that the data you get into your smart contract is as secure as possible. And we believe it's a huge importance for the TCF to gain access to data which offers redundancy and which offers basically incentives where people will be incentivized to provide the right data points without being malicious whenever they're giving out this data, right? So next one. So basically what you want to avoid is this architecture. You have a great robust system, so currently Ethereum and Hyperledger Avalon, right? And we don't want this great system to be triggered by one centralized oracle. Because if you have a super reliable system, it doesn't make sense to have it triggered by one single centralized oracle. That's what we want to avoid. We want to have redundancy at the oracle layer, where we have multiple oracles providing data from multiple data providers, right? So next one. And yeah, that's what we implemented. Basically, it's working, and we are going to commit it to the Hyperledger Avalon. It's a way to provide data to the TCF using Chainlink nodes. And I'm going to run you through the process, how it works exactly. So we have a requester contract, which is on-chain. So it can be on Ethereum, on Hyperledger, it can be on any blockchain you could think of. And it's going to send an on-chain request to a Chainlink contract, okay? This Chainlink contract is going to send to trigger a Chainlink node. This Chainlink node is basically run by blockchain infrastructure companies who are running on Ethereum or any kind of blockchain, full blockchain client, and a Chainlink node. And it's going to retrieve the external data from an API endpoint. Now, this API endpoint could be Bloomberg, it could be Reuters, it could be IoT data, it could be any kind of data you could think of, right? So once you have retrieved the data, we feed it into an adapter. Basically, this adapter is going to encrypt the data and send the work order to the TCF. The work order is basically the sequence of operations that needs to be processed inside of the TCF. And now for the most security conscious people in this room, you'll probably notice that whenever we retrieve the Chainlink, the data, and it goes through the Chainlink nodes, there is a possibility for the Oracle to corrupt the data right at this point. And that's where the beauty of TCF really comes in. Let's say I want to make sure that I want to prove that the data hasn't been tampered with by the Chainlink node, right? I will ask the data provider to sign this data. And then I can verify that this data was signed, and I can verify the signature inside of the TCF. Now, verifying signatures is a very, very consuming process, right? It's not something that you want to do on-chain. It's extremely computing. So if you were to do it inside a contract on-chain, it wouldn't be a viable option to verify this data, right? However, here, with Hyperledger Avalon, you can just verify the signature on the TCF level. And that's a huge value add. Basically, you can verify that the data was signed by the data provider, that the Chainlink node didn't tamper with it. And what you offer also is running the same data through multiple Chainlink nodes. So here you get attestation of the data, and you get decentralization through redundancy, through having multiple Chainlink nodes providing the same data point from multiple data providers, right? So we can always get more secure, but I feel like this data is already quite secure, right? What we are feeding right into the TCF has already many security assumptions that we're able to provide by combining the TCF and combining Chainlink nodes. So next slide. So yeah, once we have gotten this data, basically the process to consume it is very simple. We've computed the data, so let's say we want to, let's say we have a data provider or a smart contract creator who has a use case, he wants to get the price, but he doesn't want to transmit this price on-chain, right? So maybe he does some computation off-chain using the TCF, and he'll return the request, or the result, sorry, using the same process. We go through the adapter, we go through the Chainlink node feeds the answer to the Chainlink contract, which feeds it into the consumer contract. So a very easy process. Now, I didn't give any clear kind of use case just because the use cases for this are limitless. You can get any kind of API endpoint to feed data to smart contracts using the TCF and using Chainlink nodes. And here it goes from insurance contracts to global trade to trade finance. Basically any kind of use cases that needs data, doesn't want this data to be published on-chain because enterprises or company maybe don't really want to publish all their trades on-chain, right? But still want to use the security guarantees that TCF and Ethereum and public blockchains offer. So that's a beautiful way to do it, basically, and the possibilities are limitless. So I think I probably ran out of time, so I'm going to end here. I had a few other slides, but I think it's fine. I would like to finish by saying I think that was a beautiful effort that many companies led through EEA, through Hyperledger, and yeah, I'm really excited to see where it's gonna go. These use cases are really limitless, and in the future, what you're creating here will have a huge impact on the industry, I think, and drive companies to start using public blockchains more and more. So, thank you very much.
So now we have a last use case, Sean from Enigma.
Hi everyone, my name is John Segun. I'm one of the co-founders at Enigma, and I live right there with my colleague Ainsley, who's back there in the room. Today, it's great that I get blessed, because you mentioned an application which back in the day we worked together with Julio when he was still there. And then you guys mentioned how to get data securely in the blockchains. I'm going to talk about how we've tried to build a blockchain that is an implementation of TCF. At Enigma, our goal is to ensure adoption and usability of decentralized technologies. We focus primarily on public blockchains. The way we try to do this is by enabling blockchains, public or private, to handle sensitive data. And we've built a computation platform that enables blockchain functions or smart contracts to run with encrypted inputs, and this is done using the TCF framework. I guess the problem of privacy is very obvious. I'm not going to spend time on this. This is something that's been very dear to us. We started our research in 2015 when we were students at MIT, and at the time we were focusing on multi-party computation. We wrote two papers that are among the most cited in the industry. Fast forward 4 years, we're at the place where we're about to launch our network, which again introduces this concept of a secret contract. A secret contract is a smart contract that can run with encrypted inputs. We are seeing that this has a lot of use cases in the public blockchain ecosystem, both in terms of enabling new applications that haven't existed before, but also creating a much better UX in certain use cases. Today, I'm going to talk about Discovery, which is the first release, which will be the first release of our network in the next couple of months. Discovery is interesting because it's an implementation of TCF. We actually went our separate ways, but we converged on the same spec, more or less. It improved on TCF in two ways. One is it is a stateful network where the state is private. And the second thing is it is compatible with Ethereum, which means something that, or a contract that executes on Enigma can call a contract on Ethereum to move funds, to mint tokens, or store records of that sort. So I'm going to talk a bit about the network very quickly. There are developers who build dApps similar to Ethereum, users who interact with these dApps, and then finally workers who execute these tasks. These workers run Intel SGX devices, and that's how the network achieves its privacy feature. On a high level, the way the network works is the middle thing I have there is the secret contract concept. In this network, again, the interesting thing is the inputs are encrypted and the state is encrypted at all times. So what happens is the user sends the input. While users are sending the input, they're using our library, which ensures encryption locally and then sends the encrypted input to the network. Then we have built a P2P network where all the basically state is kept and the communication takes place. That also is encrypted at all times. The worker who's chosen to work on this task, based on a proof of stake algorithm, has the ability to decrypt both the inputs and the state of a contract, do a computation on it, and then update the Enigma state. Once the Enigma state is updated, it remains encrypted. It is visible to the user who's created the transaction. And as I mentioned, we can do computation on Ethereum. Let's wait for a second. I was going to focus a bit more on like how this applies to enterprise, but I think it's interesting to show how this can be a use case that can be used on public Ethereum. So what I want to do is I want to talk a bit more about like what we're building or what people are building using this this system. We recently built a coin mixer to achieve transactional privacy on Ethereum. We see a lot of zero-knowledge implementations that try to do that. We use our network and the secret contracts in a way to collect encrypted recipient addresses and then shuffle them in order to achieve transactional privacy. There are a lot of DeFi use cases that are interested in this. There is a lot of use cases that require auctions in order to create efficient marketplaces. This could be things like creating order books, or this could be things like having an option to say like creating a fixed income product using the interest swaps on the DeFi ecosystem. So there are things that are around this. This applies to a lot of gaming situations that we see where there's a multiplayer situation. A very simple example is rock, paper, scissors, but you can take it to the next level and build a poker game that is completely decentralized and cannot be shut down by governments, which I think is very interesting. Governance kind of falls into it because voting and things like that require comment reveals can usually benefit from it. And that's the interest and attraction we were primarily seeing in the public Ethereum level. I think one thing that's interesting for the enterprise folks and the ecosystem is, and this maybe sounds a bit bold, but I think it's a point worth making. I don't think personally the current enterprise blockchains significantly improve on the status quo of having databases. And the reason for that is primarily around privacy. We have a lot of consortium blockchains which create further data silos and have and fail the ability to tap into the network effects that create value. With something like Enigma, this can be addressed to an address because now you can have an actual blockchain where you can connect to different blockchains and parties who have conflicting business interests can interact with each other without revealing anything both from their business logic and things that trigger their contracts. So we think this is interesting. Going forward, we're excited to contribute to these specs, the Hyperledger Avalon specs, mostly around how to do shared knowledge on how to do stateful computation around the specs. So that's my presentation. Thank you very much.
So I think when we started, I was quite worried that we have so many people presenting that will like run out of time. But that was basically the session, and thanks to everyone. There's a lot of hard work that was put into this, and the main point is that the specs are mature and. You heard about this Hyperledger Avalon. It's basically EA cannot hold source code, so this work group was set up as part of Hyperledger, which under the Linux Foundation, and that's where all of this code that we're talking about will be placed. And there's a community building there already. There are like 15 to 16 companies there that are. Actually contributing both the use cases and to the spec. So we look forward to have as many people join that effort there. And the thing is the framework that Eugene talked about, we wanted to basically do it here, but given the situation, we couldn't do it. So he has the whole framework on the USB sticks.
And the blue sticks, the
and we can just pass it around, and people can just pick one for themselves.